It really is an economic Pearl Harbor. The country is facing something it hasn't faced since World War II.
This is how we see the global energy picture for the next 20 to 25 years. It is unsustainable. Unsustainable in terms of the oil and in terms of implications on the climate change.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with eye-popping headlines on the triple crisis: peak oil, climate change, and economic collapse. While America basked in Obama land, Europe quietly fell further apart over the weekend. On Martin Luther King Day, the British government announced more hundreds of billions of dollars to prop up banks and bad bets. Stocks in Barclays Bank fell to 25% in less than an hour. The largest Royal Bank of Scotland is already 80% owned by the government. Jim Rogers, the famous expatriate American billionaire, says the big American banks are themselves bankrupt. Hardly anyone argues that point anymore. I hear it all the time on radio and TV. The U.S. government tossed another $20 billion to the Bank of America and guaranteed more than $100 billion in worthless paper generated by the former Merrill Lynch. The world's largest bank, Citigroup, has lost more billions and is splitting up into two. At least a dozen countries, national governments, mind you, are close to bankruptcy themselves, not just former success stories like Iceland and Ireland. The credit rating of Spain has been downgraded. Italy may be technically bankrupt. The Balkans are a mess, as is most of Eastern Europe, right up to Latvia and Lithuania. We haven't even discussed economic chaos in the Middle East and Asia. This is it, friend. The great ship of modern production has hit the iceberg. The band may still be playing sweetly in the first-class ballroom, but the cold sea water is filling the holds below, and you know it. It will settle by degrees, no doubt. A wave of store closures this March, quiet desperation over the summer if we last that long, a lot of dancing around, new announcements, the most reckless spending moves and things you never thought of, all the stalling, the inevitable reevaluation. We have yet to live the leaden doldrums, the years of suffering before the real reformation comes. In today's program, the head of the International Energy Agency admits oil production has peaked out, and time is running out for the planet's climate. While we were all enthralled with the nonstop coverage of the U.S. elections, this speech by Fatih Birol got buried. Are you ready to cut your energy use by 9% every year? Well, get ready, because the oil is running out. In our second half hour, I'll interview Christine McDonald, author of the book Green Inc. She claims the biggest environmental groups have been covering for multinational corporations in cozy relationships for giant salaries. What will we see in the green mirror? Then we'll wrap up with Van Jones. He has a vision for those left behind in America's poverty ghettos. It's a green vision, where those with the most need produce what America needs most, carbon-free energy. Van Jones testifies to Congress later in this show. Let's start with the little matter of our oil addiction, shall we?
Sometimes it's good. Sometimes I got to do it.
Radio EcoShock.
I can see it, and I don't believe it.
Well, it's all upside down. Icons of conservative authority appear at the edge of climate change and peak oil. Hell has definitely frozen over. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Today, I'll just add the subtitles and the exclamation points as Fatih Birol, B-I-R-O-L, chief economist, takes the stolid International Energy Agency into a screeching 180-degree turn. He's just released a report showing world oil fields declining by about 9% a year. That means bits and parts of civilization will fall off. More amazing, the IEA finally recognizes no economy can survive rapid climate disruption.
Oh, what's the use? There's no petrol anyway. I don't believe there's 3 gallons of petrol left in this accursed ruin of a town. Nothing will ever fly again. Flying's over. Everything's over. Civilization's dead.
The final impossible moment, our information comes from one of the most secretive organizations of power, the Council on Foreign Relations, the dreaded CFR. For decades, activists from both the left and right named the CFR as the meeting place of global power brokers. Nasty conspiracies of war and control, attributed to the Council on Foreign Relations, fills whole books and now entire websites. This is the last place I'd expect to find important information for sophisticated EcoShock listeners. But black is now white. The CFR released a video of their meeting for December 1st, 2008 on their website, cfr.org. That spread to YouTube and then theoildrum.com. It's a new projection of our energy future, including the map of oil decline, the rise of coal, and possibly the demise of our climate system. You need to hear this speech. Let's frame the speech with this rare glimpse of the secrecy expected, even at a meeting recorded for the record, with these few quick words of warning from the CFR host.
This means that participants are welcome to make use of the information that is received at this meeting, but you should neither identify the speakers nor that of any other participant, nor should you cite a council meeting as a source of the information.
Okay, Edward L. Morse from Lewis Capital Markets. We'll try not to mention any names. Fatih Birol of the International Energy Agency begins with the ways the current financial crisis will affect energy development and climate change. That's important to know.
I would like to talk with you a few findings of the World Energy Outlook, both on the general energy picture, how we see the energy picture, and then a few words on the oil markets, how it will develop in the future, we think. And finally, a bit on the climate change issue. But before looking at the long term, just I would like to offer a couple of thoughts on the impact of financial crisis on the energy and the climate change. As Ed mentioned, we released this book on 12th of November. Since 3 weeks, we are underway, and I am talking with governments, ministers, with the industry, and so on. And based on these discussions and the things that I read, I hear, I have three major worries how this current financial crisis can affect the energy sector and the climate change debate. The first one is, there are, especially in the year 2009, I would say, there may be many postponements, delays, and cancellation of the projects, especially on the upstream projects, the independent companies, some bigger companies, some Middle East companies, national oil companies. And this postponement or the delays of these projects may well create a problem when the economy rebounds, when the demand picks up. We may well see some difficulties in the markets in a few years of time because of the postponement and cancellation or delay of these projects. This is the very first one. The second one is last year, especially in many IEA countries, OECD countries, our own governments, there was a lot of interest in putting new policies in place, more energy efficiency, more renewables, and other alternative technologies on the demand side and the supply side. There was a lot of interest, especially with the driven by the high oil prices. But I see that with the prices getting lower and the government's more and more preoccupied with the financial crisis, those preoccupations of the governments, putting new policies in place, energy efficiency, renewables, and the others, are now not anymore in many cases in the agenda. It's a pity that because we thought that those policies would help both energy security and the climate change. Thirdly, the climate change was in many countries in Europe and elsewhere on the top of the agenda till last 6 months or 1 year. Everybody thought that the governments are taking climate change, putting it on the top of the agenda. But even in Europe, with the growing financial concerns, governments are not necessarily looking at the climate change with this from the same perspective. And this is especially risky when we are approaching the Copenhagen meeting next year in 1 year of time, that the climate change is sliding down in the international policy agenda. So these are the three worries I wanted to share with you as a result of the financial crisis which could affect the energy sector and the climate change debate.
Just to review, point one, as we know, the sudden freeze in finance has already postponed, or perhaps killed off, planned investments in energy, including oil exploration and development. If the world economy picked up, energy supplies may not be there. I conclude that another wild swing in oil and gas prices could be coming down to you. Second, Western governments who talk new policies on renewables and efficiency are now preoccupied with a financial crisis instead. Alternative energy may not get off the ground either. Third, climate change is no longer, he says, at the top of the agenda. Though climate disruptions continue, governments are not dealing with it. It seems to me the Wall Street Ponzi crash has diverted political and public desire to save the atmosphere. Don't you think so? Back to Fatih Birol. Even the International Energy Agency, the invention of rich Western countries and their energy corporations, now says the fossil fuel economy is, quote, unsustainable.
In terms of our findings, just a couple of things. This is how we see the global energy picture for the next 20-25 years. And it is unsustainable. It is definitely unsustainable. And as I will show you, unsustainable in terms of the oil implications and in terms of implications on the climate change. One point I would like to highlight here is that we expect more than one-third of the growth in the global energy demand to come from coal. This is a point that I wanted to make because in many meetings like this, we sometimes forget the importance of coal in the global energy picture. In fact, the next slide, this here, it is not a forecast or anything. It is what happened in the last 7 years. This is a data. What happened in the last 7 years is that the fuels that we discuss a lot, oil, gas, renewables, and nuclear, if you add all of them together, oil on top of that, if you put gas on top of that, renewables and on top of that, nuclear, if you put all of them together, this is more or less what we got from coal in the last 7 years. So this is very important to note because this puts a big stamp for our future energy developments. We expect that the coal, especially in non-OECD countries, will play a major role in the electricity generation. It will be the backbone of the electricity generation in many years to come. We expect that more than 85% of the global coal demand will come from two countries only, China and India, two countries with high electricity demand growth rates.
One-third of growth in world energy demand will be supplied by the most carbon-polluting source, coal. Even now, in the last 7 years, if we add all of oil, gas, nuclear, and alternative energy together, Fatih Birol says, the total more or less equals the energy derived from just coal. 85% of that global coal demand will come from just two countries, China and India. That is why Fatih Birol calls repeatedly for development of carbon capture and storage technology, maybe starting in the West, but passed on very quickly to all new coal plants in Asia. Without it, some say, we lose our climate. Onward to oil.
Let me go to oil. We see in the oil demand interesting future, if I may say so. We think that the OECD oil demand more or less peaked. In 2005-2006, the levels we have, it brings us a plateau, and it will be very difficult to see that there will be a higher growth of OECD as a total in the future. In 2030, we will be using in the OECD countries less oil than we are using today. And the bulk of the growth will come from China. More than 40% of the growth will come from China, mainly driven by the transportation sector. Today in the United States, 860% out of 1,000% own a car, and in China it is today 20% out of 1,000% own a car. So there is a big difference between China and the other countries, and with the increasing income levels, Chinese will buy cars.
The OECD countries, all the developed players in Europe, North America, and Japan, have already hit their peak oil demand, says Fatih Birol. 40% of the new demand of oil will come from China alone. Later, Birol cautions that some of that oil is used by factories producing goods for Western consumption, so the carbon emissions and the cost of converting may not be all China's responsibility. We may have to pay ourselves. China's oil demand will come from their wants for cars and trucks. While 86% of Americans own a car, only 2% of Chinese people do. There's no suggestion by Birol or anyone else so far that China will bypass the combustion engine and go straight to electric.
Middle East and India also add to the global oil demand growth. One of the findings of this study is that up to now we have considered Middle East as a key oil and gas producing region. And we have seen in this study that the Middle East emerges also as a key demand center, especially in terms of oil and gas, as a result of high population growth, high economic growth, and many other energy needs, such as desalination and the others. Of course, the strong subsidies they have on the oil and energy products in general provides that basis as well. So this picture shows you that the OECD countries are becoming less and less relevant in terms of oil demand growth.
The idea that the Middle East will more and more stop exporting oil to use the energy themselves has not reached the average American at the pumps, in my opinion. You have to go to see the new refineries, the petrochemical plants, and the government-funded manufacturing to believe how the Middle East oil countries are attempting to reinvent themselves. And like the Chinese, the rapidly growing population in that area all expect to drive cars. But the real breakthrough in this report by the International Energy Agency is this. Finally, after years of foot-dragging and denial, the agency has done a thorough study of the oil supplies themselves, of the oil fields, measuring possible productions and futures. Suddenly, it seems, the IEA has converted to peak oil. In fact, they warn that supplies will drop rapidly over the coming years, including in the next few years. Yes, we're running out of oil. No, we can't overcome this with new discoveries. Here is Faith Birol on peak oil and your future at the gas pumps.
So we also looked at the supply side in depth. What we have done this year for the first time, we have analyzed 800 largest fields on a field-by-field basis. In order to understand how would the future oil picture could look like. And these 800 fields make more than 3/4 of the global reserves, more than 2/3 of the global oil production, and we have covered all the supergiant fields, almost 90% of the giant fields, and most of the large fields. And we have seen that our existing fields are declining. And there's a decline in the existing fields, especially the mature fields. And we have came to the conclusion that the decline in the existing fields is a key problem. Normally, when we talk between friends, between colleagues, how much the oil production need to grow, how much we should increase the oil production, we think it should grow as much as the demand grows, to match the demand growth. And this is wrong. Or partly wrong. We have to increase the production first in order to compensate the decline in the existing fields, and then on top of that to meet the growth in the demand. And the existing fields, as you see in the dark blue, are declining, and we think the decline can accelerate in the future, mainly because in the future we will get a lot of oil from smaller size fields and offshore fields, which have typically higher decline rates. If I can say summarized version, today we produce worldwide or consume about 86 million barrels per day. If we were to assume that the global oil demand would be completely flat 25 years, zero growth, 85, if we want to stay there, we need to increase the production by 45 million barrels per day, 45 million barrels per day new production, which would mean more or less 4 new Saudi Arabias. Even if we were to stay in the, we wouldn't increase the oil demand at all. If you want to increase the oil demand, If the oil demand goes as we expected, about 20 million barrels per day, this would mean 65 million barrels per day, then we would need six Saudi Arabias in order to offset the decline and compensate and meet the growth in the demand. Now, can this be done? So when we look at the reserves, resource basis, we think that the, our total conventional, unconventional oil endowment is good enough to make this happen in theory. But I think the main problem is the following, whether or not the investments will come. We see in the next years to come a sea change in the oil industry structure. More than 80% of the growth in the oil production will need to come from national oil companies, mainly in Middle East, some of them in former Soviet Union, in Latin America and elsewhere.
This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to Fatih Birol, Chief Economist for the International Energy Agency, speaking to the Council on Foreign Relations, December 1st, 2008. Birol will continue to explain why peak oil is upon us and what that means, but first, he outlines a telling difference in the roles of nationalized oil companies compared to corporate giants like ExxonMobil.
I don't want to say that national oil companies is better or worse than the international oil companies, but this is a new context. National oil companies have different tasks, building schools, building hospitals, building other infrastructure things. In the case of national oil companies, it is not the market conditions which gives them the invest or not to invest, or it is not the only market conditions. They have other plus preoccupations, mainly domestic preoccupations, which can give them the decisions to invest or not. So it will be a different context. The investment decision will be made based on different factors than what we have seen in the past. The dark blue in the previous picture you saw declining is most of them are in the control of the international oil companies, and they have difficulties to access the reserves which are under the control of the national oil companies. So therefore, if you put these two pictures together, the decline in the existing fields plus the change in the game, if I may say so, in the oil industry may have implications for our oil industry in the next years to come.
Get it? National oil companies have to do crazy things like pay for schools and hospitals, while multinationals just pay out dividends to stockholders. Well, why should ExxonMobil or Shell have to bother themselves about the population where they get their oil? Anyway, the amount of oil controlled by the former multinational giants is in steep decline. I have heard that the famous Seven Sisters and their derivatives like BP and Total now control less than 5% of the world's oil supplies. While Western activists flail away at the oil multinationals, in fact, they are becoming almost impotent. The relevant suppliers are actually countries like Russia, Venezuela, and so on. Oil has become more political than corporate. Back to Fatih Birol of the IEA as he now tackles climate change. It's so shocking to hear this from the halls of power.
So let me tell you a couple of things on the climate change and finish this brief presentation. The very first picture I showed you, that the oil fuels, oil, coal, gas, and so on, implies an increase in the temperature, which will bring us to up to 6 degrees Celsius increase in compared to previous decades. And this is definitely unacceptable. Energy is responsible more than two-thirds of the global emissions. And when we look at the future, we see that the OECD emissions are more or less stable, and the bulk of the emissions will come from the non-OECD countries. Again, China, India, and Middle East play the key role there. And the good thing is that now everybody, almost everybody in the world, believes that we have to find a solution to climate change problem. This is the good thing. But the bad thing is we don't agree who is going to do what, who will share what part of the responsibility. This is the challenge that we are facing. Now, as International Energy Agency, you will see in our book, if we have time, we have proposed a post-Kyoto framework which looks at the cap and trade as the upcoming administration suggests as one of the key options. We look at the sectoral approaches and we look at the voluntary policies and measures according to the country's affordability. And we have looked at two different trajectories. One of them is, as opposed to 6 degrees, a 3 degrees increase, which is about 550 ppm, as it's called, and the other one is a 2 degrees, which is 450 ppm, which is suggested by the EU leaders, G8 leaders, and recent statement, again, made by the president-elect, to bring the U.S. emissions in 2020 to 1990 level is under 450 ppm, in other words, 2 degrees temperature increase. What needs to be done to come there? So the red one is, again, 6 degrees increase. The blue one is a 3 degrees increase corresponds. And this green one is the 450, the famous 450 that everybody wants to come. But is it possible? Let me give you two, three numbers, and I will leave it to you to decide if it is possible or not. In terms of the 450, this the yellow part, energy efficiency, the most important one compared to all others, means that we have to increase the global energy efficiency each year, the improvement each year, should be 2.4%. And just that you know, between 2000 and 2007, in the last 7 years, energy efficiency increased by 1% only. Second, in terms of renewables, in the year 2007, last year, we have, for example, wind installed capacity about 90 gigawatt, and 90 gigawatt we were able to come to 90 gigawatt as a result of huge efforts of the last two decades. In order to come to this 450 ppm level, we have to build worldwide each year 45 gigawatt. So we have to build each year half of what we have built in the last two decades in terms of wind capacity. In terms of nuclear power, we have to build each year to come to 450 about 20 nuclear power plants each year, and currently we are building 1.5. And carbon capture storage, I showed the coal picture, is very important to play a role. Otherwise, we have no chance to address the coal issue. My final slide is, for me, the most difficult part of the equation. Let me explain you what it is, and for me, the biggest challenge. This shows you three scenarios. We have the reference scenario with the current policies in place, and 550 and 450, and how much the CO2 emissions will be in the year 2030. For example, if you look at the green bar, in order to come to 450, global CO2 emissions in the year 2030 should be around 25 gigaton. Now, if when you look at the first part, red and yellow, if the OECD countries' emissions tomorrow would be zero completely, we will still not be able to reach the 450. So in other words, if I'm not talking about the emission reductions, 20%, 15%, if the emissions, if the economy in the OECD countries tomorrow would completely be crashed, we are very close to that anyways, but if it was 25 years like that, no economic activity, no energy use, no CO2 emissions, we will still not be able to reach the 450 case. And the main problem here is that those countries, the non-OECD countries, do not put the climate change on the anywhere up in their international policy agenda. So with these words, I finish here, and perhaps we can elaborate more in the discussion with Ed. Thank you very much.
And now you've heard the whole speech, nothing left out. That was Fatih Birol, chief economist to the International Energy Agency, speaking to the Council on Foreign Relations on December 1st, 2008. I leave it to you, but my impression was his pessimism. The Western oil-based lifestyle will not be able to continue. We have reached peak oil and are entering a period of rapid and relentless decline of oil supplies. And the alternatives include a lot of climate-killing coal. We are unlikely to keep global warming below 2 degrees, he says, and may go much higher than that. No wonder even the biggest capitalists are listening now. You can find a video of this speech at CFR.org and at theoildrum.com in the entry by Nate Hagens, January 8, 2009. The 62-minute presentation includes a question and answer period, but I think I've covered the most important points. Anyway, I'm Alex Smith. Find this broadcast at our website, ecoshock.org, That's one of hundreds of free MP3 downloads on energy, the environment, and our general human crisis. Thank you for tuning in.
In just a few seconds, Radio EcoShock will be right back with Christine McDonald and Van Jones.
You have stumbled upon Radio EcoShock, the weekly one-hour crisis broadcast. Here's just a few of the headlines that got my attention recently. The managing director of the world's biggest bond fund, Bill Gross of PIMCO, admits the whole economy was really a Ponzi scheme. Move over, Bernie Madoff. Gross said the U.S. has been running, quote, our Ponzi-style economy, end quote. Another bright light, Meredith Whitney, the stock analyst who bravely said the Emperor of Wall Street had no clothes, now says that all of the $300 billion of U.S. government TARP money has simply vanished, covering bank losses. No wonder there's no money to loan. Pretty predictable, really, wasn't it? Coming generations will be harnessed to debt for absolutely nothing, at least until they refuse. Meanwhile, on the climate front, Indonesia has announced over $1 billion for new railroads. Hey, that does sound like good news. Well, it's not. The rails will move coal reserves from South Sumatra to the coal ships, onward to Asia's multiplying coal stations and runaway climate change. Climate blogger Joseph Rome, recently a guest on Radio EcoShock, points out a new study published in Geophysical Research Letters. Scientists from South Korea's Pohang University found, quote, sudden considerable reduction in recent uptake of anthropogenic CO2 by the East Japan Sea. If true, the ocean burial ground for our carbon binge may be full. Next week on Radio EcoShock, we'll talk with a top American scientist who questions that research. He should know. Peter Tans is chief scientist for NOAA's Global Carbon Monitoring Program. Don't miss that. He's got a lot to say. At climateprogress.org, Joe Rome also writes, China announces plan to single-handedly destroy the climate. China to increase coal production 30% by 2015. That big increase in coal power was just announced by the government of China. The increase, Rome writes, will be, quote, an amount equal to 2/3 of the entire coal consumption of the United States, an amount that surpasses all of the coal consumed today in Europe, Eurasia, the Middle East, Africa, and Central and South America, end quote. Mommy, how do you spell toasted planet? As the Titanic settles, there are more fancy balls to attend. Kate Shepard wrote about two supposedly green inauguration parties in Gristmill, the environmental blog for January 19th. I quote her at length now. Tonight's dueling balls showcase an interesting dichotomy within the green movement. Gore's ball, that would be Al Gore, which has more of an activist bent, is co-hosted by the Sierra Club, the Natural Resources Defense Council, Earth Justice, and Vote Solar Initiative, and Youth Environmental Sanity, among many other groups and businesses. Walmart, KPMG, and the American Gas Association are also on the board, but these and other corporate sponsors have incorporated green practices into their businesses, say the Gore folk. The organizers are decorating with tree seedlings, used recycled fiber carpet, recycling and composting waste, and offsetting their carbon emissions. The food is going to be organic and cooked across the street to lower the carbon footprint, Natch. Will.i.am and Maroon 5 will serenade the crowd. Kate Shepard continues, the International Conservation Caucus Foundation's ball is hosted by the Nature Conservancy, Conservation International, and WWF, among others, and will be just a few blocks down the street. Quote, roses will be flown in from Ecuador. Marinated beef is being flown in from Texas to Virginia, where it will be grilled and then trucked to the auditorium, reports the Times. We are not into symbolism, said Caucus President David H. Barron. We are focused on a much bigger impact. As the Times puts it, the Caucus Gala sticks to its philosophy that the environment and wildlife are most effectively protected by governments and businesses. To that end, sponsors include ExxonMobil, Chevron, International Paper, and Walmart, which appears to be hedging its bets. Famous anticipated guests including Robert Duvall, Bo Derek, and Ed Norton, end quote from Kate Shepard at gristmill.grist.org. And that leads us to our next report here on Radio EcoShock with Christine McDonald. She worked for Conservation International and didn't like the company it keeps. Are some green movement bigwigs living it up off your donations? Journalist Christine McDonald says some of them are in her new book. It's got a provocative title, Green Ink, An Environmental Insider Reveals How a Good Cause Has Gone Bad. It's published by Lions Press. Welcome, Christine.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I got to admit, when I first heard about your book, I was a little suspicious. There have been so many vapid anti-environmental books cranked out by some right-wing think tank or a PR company. But I found that your book is genuine and you've got a real point to make. How did you get to writing it?
Well, I had the opportunity to work at one of the preeminent environmental groups in the world, Conservation International, and I was really troubled by the mismanagement and the corporate greenwashing I saw going on there. So I was laid off after about 5 months in a reorganization, and instead of going off and looking for another job in another similar group, I felt I had a responsibility to speak up and get some of these issues out on the table.
Yeah, well, let's start with Conservation International. Just to orient listeners, what is the general mission of that group?
Conservation International is a conservation group that works in, it doesn't work in the United States. It works in about 40 countries. Mostly in developing world countries where the majority, where most of the world's biodiversity can be found today in rainforests and other very fragile ecosystems that are under a lot of pressure.
And are they managing to accomplish some of that goal? How much of the earth have they protected?
Well, Conservation International, like the other groups that I look at, such as World Wildlife Fund and the Nature Conservancy, of course, do some good work. They hire and use as consultants some of the best scientists in the world, and they have succeeded in preserving some delicate ecosystems in areas that they have designated as, using scientific information they've designated as hot spots or ecoregions that are very important. But if you look at the bigger picture of who is funding them and the relationships that they've developed, they receive a lot of corporate funding from some of the most polluting corporations on the planet, oil and gas companies, mining companies, power companies, logging companies. And these companies use their relationships with the environmental groups to depict themselves as green companies, as environmentally friendly companies, when that certainly isn't the case.
I got the sense from the book that you felt a bit betrayed and angry. What disappointed you the most?
Almost immediately after I began at Conservation International, I had a number of wake-up calls, and I think probably the first one happened after I'd been at the organization only a week or two. I went to the weekly editorial meeting in which 30 or 40 communications officers for the organization would gather together and talk about their projects. And one of the projects that was discussed was a public relations campaign that was about to roll out with the British petroleum company, BP. And BP, you might know, it has a very successful green marketing campaign, but their environmental record is atrocious. And they spend very little of their operating budget on green endeavors. They spend, I think, 4% of their entire spending on wind, solar, gas, and everything else that they consider renewable, and while they spend about 16 times as much on their oil and gas exploration and production. In this meeting, one of the public relations officers was talking about a public relations campaign that was about to roll out with CI. Depicting, kind of touting the benefits of BP's environmental record. And only a few days earlier, I had read in the newspaper that the Environmental Protection Agency had named BP as the most polluting company in the United States for that year, for the previous year. And that the and actually their one refinery that was named in this by the Environmental Protection Agency was so polluting that it had lowered the quality of the air quality for the entire country. So I was sitting in this meeting thinking, why are we working with such a polluting company, and debating with myself whether I should bring this up, when one of my colleagues actually did bring it up and said exactly what I was thinking. But no one else in the room, I thought she was very brave to do so, and that is an illustration that there are good people working inside these organizations, but they're in the minority, and many people feel cowed and don't feel that they can speak out. And because no one else in the room of about 40 people had anything to say, there was an awkward silence. The reaction was as if she had said something incredibly rude, and a few minutes later, the meeting resumed as if she had never made her comment about the fact that we were partnering with a polluting company like BP. And then shortly after that, the PR campaign rolled out.
Oh, excuse me, aren't you the people that are killing the planet? Well, there's one paragraph I just wanted to read out for our listeners on page 200 that I thought really encapsulated some of what you have to say. It says, international conservationists, once perceived as watchdogs guarding the public interest, are now widely seen as members of the elite, insiders invited into the backroom dealings between governments and corporations, and therefore unwilling to speak out against them even when species and landscapes are at stake. Could you give us another example of that?
Yes. Well, the leaders of these organizations, for the most part, make within the top 1%. Their salaries are so high that they're in the top 1% of U.S. taxpayers. The salaries range from the mid $300,000 a year range to over $800,000 a year, and they spend much of their time traveling to exotic places on supposed fact-finding missions with corporate moguls and Hollywood celebrities. And they always stay at the top hotels. They often travel in gas-guzzling private jets, and they use Land Rovers and yachts to get around. These ties have led to some very questionable liaisons. For instance, Conservation International and the Nature Conservancy have relationships with big grain traders such as Cargill and Bunge Limited. And they have projects going on in Brazil in which they have used the money that these grain traders have given them to preserve some environmentally sensitive land in the Amazon and in other ecosystems in Brazil, which is positive. But at the same time, these companies are propelling deforestation in Brazil and in other countries that have some of the last old-growth forests standing on the planet today. So they're providing greenwashing cover for these companies, and the companies make a lot of use of it in their sustainability reports and in their public relations campaigns.
So one hand washes the other, but both hands sort of get dirty, I suppose. I should tell listeners that Christine isn't writing a tabloid scandal type of book. You won't find any sex slave rings or Bernie Madoff scams revealed in the Green movement. The Greens look pretty tame compared to Washington and Wall Street these days. Am I correct to say that you wrote the book more about principle?
Yes. Well, when I left CI, I guess I felt as if I was out of a job, but there was still plenty of work to be done. I felt strongly about the environment, and I wanted to work to improve the environment. And so I felt this was the best way I could do it, by trying to start this debate and really spark a reform, because we're at a moment in history in which we really need our environmental groups to act responsibly and to act as watchdogs in the public interest, and not as lapdogs of corporations.
Well, you know, Christine, anybody who's been in the movement for a few years knows there's really two green movements. You've got the sort of Teddy Roosevelt rich people saving the park style, and they're used to having the best for themselves, sort of like rich kids playing green. But there is also a movement of millions of people, according to Paul Hawken anyway, working hard with practically no budget. They're trying to save a valley from a mine or a rare bird or something, and they go broke paying for their own faxes and phone bills. Those smaller groups are not really in your book, and I'm worried that readers will think that all environmentalists are like the ones you describe.
You bring up a good point, and I try to point this out, especially in the introduction to the book, that there are more than 12,000 environmental groups in this country alone, and you have all types of groups, large and small, corporate friendly, and much more independent groups. And there are so many groups that are doing good work, and I think especially at the grassroots level or at the community level, a lot of groups are doing such important and necessary work. And I would say that you just have to look individually at many of these groups, because even at the lower, you know, at the more local levels, you do have some groups that work very closely with corporations and might be making some questionable decisions. But you also have wonderful groups that are doing very good and courageous work.
Well, I was a little annoyed that the back jacket at least tossed Greenpeace in with the baddies. And when I went through the book, I did find only five or six references and really nothing that bad about Greenpeace. I mean, it says they met with some corporations, but they also hung themselves off the corporate office towers of the same people, likely. So, you know, I was disappointed to find Greenpeace in there, really.
Really, Greenpeace, I use Greenpeace more as a, I use a lot of their reports, and I agree that Greenpeace and the Rainforest Action Network and some of the more confrontational groups have definitely had a better record of getting corporations to change their policies than the more polite organizations such as Conservation International, which claim to be influencing the corporations to change their policies. But if you look, if you go from case to case, there's really no backup for that claim. Actually, they seem more like enablers who enable these corporations to continue to greenwash. The only instance I found of a questionable relationship that Greenpeace was involved in is something called the biodiversity, what is it called? I'm blanking on the name now. But Greenpeace is a board member of a biodiversity credits organization that's spearheaded by Conservation International and Forest Trends, another NGO. And basically what they are doing is they're pioneering carbon credits to save forest lands around the country and some of those endeavors that they're involved in are very questionable. For instance, there's one open pit mining project in Madagascar that's going up in place of a primary forest, of an old growth forest in Madagascar. And the mining consortium says clearly in their documentation that the reason that they're partnering with these non-profit environmental organizations is that they need to convince the local community and regulators to back the project, and they also need to convince the international banks, who are reluctant to finance a project like this because of a specious environmental impact, to provide the funding for it. And this is just one of many examples of nonprofit groups that are providing backing to corporations that are involved in mining and other really devastating projects. And you have to really question, why aren't the nonprofits concerned about their reputation? The mining company says that the banks are reluctant to lend them the money because the banks are concerned that they will lose their reputation for backing a mining project on primary forest. And yet you have to wonder, why are the environmental organizations willing to back this project when even the banking industry is reluctant?
Some really good questions. And two targets I thought you hit well, too, were the World Wildlife Fund and Adam Werbeck. The WWF has pulled off some really skunky deals over the years, and I think most longtime environmental insiders could tell you about that, and they've been hoping that the book will finally be written on them. And Adam Werbeck, he was the supposedly the youngest member of the Sierra Club, or youngest president of the Sierra Club, but all that proved was he really wasn't mature enough to find his way around in the green movement, because then he went on to say environmentalism is dead, and then, as you say, went to work for Walmart. How do you find this whole Walmart connection working out and its greening promises?
Well, Walmart has definitely taken some strides in the right direction. The problem is that they're just about every aspect of their business model is anti-ecological. And how do you address that? They haven't shown, at least so far, the company has really fallen short in terms of addressing that overall issue of how can you make a company like Walmart environmentally friendly. So on the one hand, they've done some positive made some positive steps, but they are definitely reaping a lot of environmental rewards from this. And when you see how they've been able to co-opt people like Werbeck and so many other environmentalists, it really tells you a lot about the strategy that a lot of corporations take by providing money to environmentalists. And that's the thing. I mean, there's nothing wrong with corporations becoming more environmentally sensitive. As a matter of fact, we need our my position is we need corporations to step up and really step up to the challenge that we're facing and pioneer new ways, come up with new entrepreneurial ways to create a green economy, a sustainable economy. But on the other hand, whenever a corporation gives money to an environmental group, we always have to guard against the possibility that this money is a bribe. Polluters have a long record of co-opting their critics, and we always have to guard against the possibility that the corporation is giving this money in order to co-opt the organization and the individuals and to weaken their mission. And we've seen that over and over again.
We are talking with Christine McDonald, the author of Green Ink, How a Good Cause Has Gone Bad. What have I missed, Christine? What else should our listeners know about as we wrap up here?
Well, let's see. Well, I think the most important thing to remember is that we need to start a debate about how to reform the movement. A lot of people say, yes, but how could these nonprofit groups survive without corporate money? But I think that question has really been, that's kind of a moot question today. I mean, if you look at Barack Obama's fundraising campaign, for instance, he was able to galvanize support using the Internet and galvanize support from individuals in an unprecedented way. Why can't environmental groups that started as grassroots movements, and why can't they do the same and galvanize people's concern? Opinion poll after opinion poll show that people are concerned about the environment, and they want measures taken, and they want to be part of a solution to this problem. So I think we're in a historic moment. We need our environmental groups to take a hard look at the way they're reacting, and those that are making questionable relationships with corporations should think twice. And we really need to see a re-energized movement that reaches out to the grassroots and inspires people to not only contribute money, but to contribute their time and think about and change the way they're living if we're going to address this historic crisis, but also this historic opportunity.
Thank you, Christine. The book is Green Ink, available from Lions Press and all booksellers. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, and that's enough green navel-gazing. I'd like to take you now to the committee rooms of Congress to hear another great African-American voice, Van Jones. This is the House Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming, chaired by the remarkable Ed Markey. They get the best. In this brief testimony on January 15, 2009, Van Jones explains how to beat America's energy poverty while giving work to those who need it most.
Mr. Chairman, other committee members, I'm just happy to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk. I was here in 2007 when the term green-collar job was very rarely heard anywhere. This may have been the first place it was heard in Congress, and now it is everywhere, and that reflects something. It reflects a hunger and a desire on the part of the American people to solve the two biggest crises possibly ever to face this country, an economic catastrophe and a climate crisis, both of which could undermine our nation's security, our economy, not just now but for decades into the future. Unlike the rest of us, next week we're going to be celebrating. You'll celebrate for about 10 minutes and then you're going to go back to sweating over the details of this recovery, sweating over the details of how it is that we can actually beat the recession and global warming at the same time. The 111th Congress will be in the history books. 100 years from now, students will study this Congress, and they will ask one question. Were you able to solve the problem? Were you able to deal with this twin crisis? How did you do it? And you're going to get a grade from our great-grandchildren, yes or no, pass or fail. The reason that green jobs are so important is because they are the most secure way to ensure success for this Congress. And the whole country now is looking for a change. You have the opportunity to turn this breakdown into a breakthrough. And you can if you honor three principles. Number one, this is the chance for America finally to return to its roots as the most important economy in the world. Not because we are the number one consumers, but because we are the number one producers. Congressman Inslee pointed out that there is an opportunity to bring green manufacturing jobs back to this country, making batteries, making wind turbines, doing those things in the United States. Let us seize the opportunity to abandon the idea that we can forever be the most important economy in the world based on consumption, based on consumerism, based on credit cards. Let's get back to building rather than borrowing in the United States, number one. Number two, as we honor Congressman Sensenbrenner's plea for accountability, and I will underscore that, we don't want to see any more wasted money. Right. We can't afford it. We don't want to see any more of the Katrinas and those kind of things. We can't afford it. But as we do that, let's make sure we get our math right. This is a green economy we're trying to build. And in a green economy, the math is different. You don't just count what you spend. You count what you save. This is the key point. When you're building a green economy, you don't just count what you spend. You count what you save. And a massive investment, as the mayors are calling for, in energy efficiency will save us money over the long term. And that's the importance of the energy efficiency and conservation block grant that the mayors have fought so valiantly for. The third is simply this. We have an opportunity to do something that no generation of Americans has ever had the opportunity to do. We can build a green economy that Dr. King would be proud of. We have the opportunity to connect the people who most need work with the work that most needs to be done and fight pollution and poverty at the same time and be one country about it. We have a chance to slow up for just a second, as Congressman Cleaver said. We might have to delay 2 weeks to help some of the young men and young women that you represent to get a little bit more training to get involved. We might have to wait 3. We might have to hold up a month to get some of these young folks coming home from wars, coming home from prisons, coming out of high school. We might have to even wait an extra month to get them trained to become a part of this. But if we do that, we will have built a green wave that can lift all boats. We will have created green pathways out of poverty. We will have shown a new generation of Americans that we can stand together and do great things again, and that differences of color and class, starting point differences, don't matter, because we have a big future we're trying to fight for together. You, as the leaders of the 111th Congress, on this most pressing issue, have the opportunity to make us the number one producer in the world, to change the math so we count what counts. Right? We don't just count what we spend, we also count what we save, and to connect the people who most need work to the work that most needs to be done. And if you do that, our great-great-grandchildren will give you an A+. Thank you very much.
Van Jones is both a civil rights activist and environmental advocate in Oakland, California. His Green Jobs program came out of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. He's got a website at vanjones.net. I'm Alex Smith. You can find my Kingdom of Free Green Audio at ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. Save yourself, your neighborhood, or just a lonely planet. Load up your iPod or computer with free MP3 files on the triple threats, the environment, peak oil, and the new hard times. Mother Earth will thank you. Well, until next week, my friends.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climbs and true currents in thriving seas, wind blowing through breathing trees, strong ozone and safe sunshine. Good planets are what? Hard to find. Good planets are in demand. Clean beaches and sparkling sands and the land masses, room to spare. That's good, yeah. Jet streams and perfect air, high forests and low wetlands, good planets are in demand. And the mind don't know, and the heart can't see, let the blind man go, Gratitude is a destiny. Yeah. Good planets are rare indeed. Rain falling on crops and seed. Big rivers and good topsoil. Fuel sources from cane to oil. Green garden full of wind. Good planets are rare indeed. All right.